Today we're talking about Daniel 7 through 8. And this is something I've been looking forward to because this is the section where I get to do a little angelology. And the sophomores, when we do the Screwtape letters, right at the beginning of the Screwtape letters, I give them this little PowerPoint called Angelology 101. And mostly, of course, what I'm trying to do is just counteract all the things that they have about angels from movies. Maybe you know, when you watch things about Minnesota in movies, maybe like 80% of it is false. And I would say with angels and devils, you know, it's more like 95% of it is false. And not to say that it can't be entertaining, because like It's a Wonderful Life. Who can't like Clarence Oddbody, Angel Second Class? But of course, there's a very basic error there that human beings become angels. And human beings don't become angels. Angels are spirits. They always were spirits. They always will be spirits. Human beings are body and soul. We're meant to be body and soul. So even after death, that there's a sort of split of body and soul, that's something that, remember, in Christian doctrine, is going to be reconciled at the resurrection. You are meant to get your body back. To be human means to have a body. And so that's why there's something incomplete about you, just as sort of a soul flitting around up there. It is very important that on the last day, when the books are read and the trump of doom and the graves are opened, that, God willing, you will have a glorified body. You will rise unto life. Okay? But angels do not have bodies and never have bodies. Now, that's important to keep in mind as you think about the Old Testament, because when the Old Testament talks about angels, when you think about Genesis, when you think about Exodus, angels appear, and they appear really as kind of human beings. But human beings who have this sort of strange air about them. Like, they're not quite your next-door neighbors. They're not quite from around here. You do have that sense. And think about even as in the book of Judges, when an angel appears to Manoah and his wife, right, Samson's parents, that they realize, sort of after the fact, that there's something supernatural about this being. Okay, the information in general that's given early on in the Old Testament of angels is very veiled, and it's understandable why it is. You are trying to lead the chosen people. You're trying to lead the Israelites to understand that there is one God, and there aren't all these many gods that people believe in throughout the Near Eastern world. You are not going to start, for example, the book of Genesis by teaching that there are millions and millions of spirits surrounding the divine glory. All that is going to do is confuse people. Okay. Now, if you read St. Augustine will say there are ways in which the creation of the angels are spoken of. So when it says, "Let there be light," and God separated the light from the darkness, Augustine will say, well, that light is not a material light. You don't have a material light until the fourth day with the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars. That light is a spiritual light. That is the angels. And when you're told that he separated the light from the darkness, that is the rebellion of the evil angels. Okay? So there is a way in which you're being told, but yes, you're being told it in a veiled way that will be revealed more explicitly later on. Now, this is this book, Daniel, is an important moment in sort of revealing things about the angels, because as strange as it may sound to you, it doesn't hit you until you reflect on it, start looking backwards. This is the first book that you get angelic names. You don't get angelic names in Judges or Joshua or Kings or Exodus. Okay, and in this book, you get two of them. Okay, so. Over here, Gabriel, you're told this name in 8:16, and also in 9:21. And then later on, the only other mention of Gabriel is in Luke, right? 1:19 and 1:26. Here's where he appears to Zechariah. We all know how that turned out. Zechariah didn't get to talk for 9 months. And then 1:26, that's the Annunciation. That's where he speaks to Our Lady and gets a very, very different reception. Okay, so basically, it's these four times. And then Michael, who we're going to see in our next reading, chapter 10, verses 13, 21, and then at the beginning of chapter 12, that's when we run into Michael. Michael only occurs two other times. He's mentioned in the book of Jude, the letter of Jude, I should say. It's this very short letter, and he's there. And then the Apocalypse, 12:7. This is the verse, of course, we're all familiar with. There was a great war in heaven, and Michael with his angels. Okay, so look at that. Gabriel, we've basically got four verses. That's it. Michael, we've got five verses. So their appearances are very brief. Okay, and there's only one other angel in Scripture that's named. Again, if you're looking at a Protestant Bible, this is considered Apocrypha, but the Book of Raphael. The Book of Tobias. Raphael is named in Tobias. I didn't look up the exact verse where he's in, but I want to say it's like chapter 7 or 8. It's later on in the Book of Tobias where he reveals who he is. He reveals who he is to Tobias. Okay? So Raphael, Gabriel, Michael, these are the only names we're given. And again, it's understandable if what you're trying to prevent is another form of paganism or polytheism. Right, you don't want angel worship. In fact, even some of the names like Michael, that means who is like God. So it's a name that points the reader to God, and in general, that's what angelic names do. Gabriel, Gabriel, Gabra is the Hebrew word for might or strength or power. So like might of God. It's a kind of a funny contrast when you think about these Renaissance paintings of Gabriel, and he always, he's kneeling before Our Lady, and he always looks kind of a little femmy. And in the Hebrew tradition, this was the angel that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. When you think about this rain of fire and brimstone, that's the might of God angel carrying out his job. Okay. So in the Hebrew tradition, he's the angel that does that. Raphael, Raf, is the word for healing, so that God heals. And of course, that's very important in that book, because Tobias, if you remember, is healed from the blindness that he has, and also the it's Tobit. Tobias is the son. Tobit's the father. Tobias is the son. And then Tobias's wife. Who's had one husband after another killed by this demon, by Asmodeus. He also heals that, right? He binds this devil. One of the fact that you're getting names of angels here and sort of more information about the angels, of course, if you're a historical biblical critic, you're going to make some hay with this, and what you're going to say is that, well, the Israelites now living in the captivity here, basically they're picking up beliefs from the Babylonians and the Persians. So it's not that this is some kind of like new insight here. No, they're just allowing their religion to be influenced by this other religion or this different religion. Okay, right? Really? Right out of the gate? Go ahead, Karen.
Well, Raphael, in Jewish tradition, is present when Moses erects the snake on the...
Oh, okay, yep.
He's the one that brings healing to Israel, to those okay. who look upon that. Raphael is the Hebrew word, as you said, for healing, and it's said that Raphael... is here, that God brings healing through Raphael.
Yeah, so the angel's doing the healing. Also, by the way, in the Gospel of John, remember there's this angel that stirs the waters, and everybody's trying to get to the water in time to be healed, and there's this guy who's been there for like 37 years and he can never get to the water in time. The early Christian tradition was that was Raphael. Raphael's the angel of the pool, the angel who's carrying out these miraculous healings. Okay. So back to my biblical critic. Remember that Babylonians and Persians, the thing that's true here is that they do have a belief in spirits, which let's say that the Canaanites don't. Remember, for the Canaanites, they've got like Ashtoreth and Baal and Moloch. They've got a mythology which is kind of like Greek mythology or Egyptian mythology, where they're like big people or sort of important people or supernatural people. The Persians, remember, the Persians have this Zoroastrian religion. For us, when we think about Iran, we tend to lump them together with the rest of the Middle East, and we tend to just think of them all as sort of, they're all Muslims. But remember, the Persians are sort of the oddballs in the Near Eastern world. They're not Arabs. Persians are not Arabs, and they're not related to the Arabs. Remember last week I showed you all these language groups: Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian, Ge'ez in Ethiopia, the Berber languages. These are all Semitic languages that are related to each other. Pardon me. The Persians are not related to those people. They're a different group. Persian means they're not related. Their language is completely different. And they're racially completely different. And so their religion is very different. And there are these sort of survivals in even Persian beliefs now, or Persian legends, which go back to the Zoroastrian period. They're not Muslim at all. So, for example, just loaded up on Netflix, I want to say about a year ago, there's this Persian movie. It's an Iranian movie. It's called Under the Shadow. And it's about this woman who's being terrorized by a jinn, by what we say a genie. Okay? And it's wonderful because, you know, if you grew up in the 70s, there were all these wonderful horror movies in the 70s. And a lot of modern horror movies, they all work by special effects. They all work by computer generated. And if you remember, a lot of those horror movies in the 70s, they were really grew out of that kind of Twilight Zone school of, it was suspense. It was all suspense. It was all what you did in your imagination more than what you saw. So that Under the Shadow movie is actually really enjoyable. It's like those 70s suspense movies than it is, like modern horror movies. But think about this. Here in the modern age, if you're going to make an Iranian horror movie, you make it about genies and jinn. That's not Muslim. That is pre-Muslim. That goes all the way back. That's 2,000 years, 2,500 years ago that this was Persian legend. So they already have this sense that there are these spiritual beings out there, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. Okay? And the good ones are under Ahura Mazda or Asmad, and you know, the bad ones, they have their own, you know, they have their own a leader and so on. And someone like Cardinal Newman, when he was still in the Church of England, he addresses this and he says, you know, is it the case that the Hebrew people or the Israelites in exile, that they're just sort of adopting what it is that this other religion believes? And he said, no, why not take the other point of view, that schooled as they are in the beliefs of the Chaldeans, remember that's what you're told about Daniel at the very beginning of the book, that Daniel is hearing about this from these Chaldeans, but he's seeing something in it that the Persians are not seeing, perhaps. He is he's coming through what they're saying, perhaps, to a realization of what these beings really are. Remember that in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and Pharaoh back in Exodus, you can have pagans. They're in some way coming to a knowledge of things, and they're coming to a knowledge of things from God. But they don't fully understand what they're getting. And so, certainly one possibility is, yes, you are getting now kind of more information about the angels. But maybe that is something that God is, in a way, making known to Daniel through what he's encountering in Babylonia, because it's close enough to the coming of Christ that the Israelites can get more information of the angels and not become idolatrous. Okay? Because that's always the concern. Are you telling them something that's going to be harmful to them? Are you telling them something that's sort of going to lead them astray into angel worship, spirit worship? Is this the point where you can tell them there are spirits, there are spirits that serve God, and here even are their names? Okay? And there are things that you get out of Daniel. For example, are there lots of angels? You know, how many angels are there? And you get this phrase, myriads of myriads. Now, a myriad is the Greek word for 10,000. So when you say myriads of myriads, that's like an uncountable multitude. Like the way when Peter asks, if my brother offend me, how many times should I forgive him? Like seven? He thinks he's being pretty generous. And our Lord responds, 70 times seven. So the wrong response is, okay, 490? I'm retro counting some of these earlier forgiveness that I've done. No, you're not meant to take it as a number. 10,000 by 10,000 means almost an uncountable multitude. So later on in the church fathers, when they will talk about the attributes of the angels, and they'll ask the question, you know, how many angels are there? Are there a lot? Are there a few? They will ground the view that, in fact, there are more angels than there are material beings, you know, on that text. That, so in other words, when you think of the spiritual realm, don't think of the spiritual realm being like maybe there are 12 angels up there, you know, sort of like ancient Rome or ancient Greece when you had the mythology, where you've got like this limited pantheon of gods. I mean, there are places where you're told, remember, I think it's Raphael who says, I am one of the seven who stand before God. Okay? Well, does that just mean there are like seven angels up there sort of rattling around the place? No. It is more fitting. This is what someone like St. Thomas will say. It's more fitting that the better a thing is, that the more of them there are. If you've got these spiritual beings and they're higher and better, oh, more the merrier. Have lots of them. So don't think of the angels as being few. Okay, and again, even if the things that Daniel and those who are with them are being told are sound similar to things that are Babylonian or Persian, the claim here, I guess, that Newman's making is that would just be the occasion. That would just be the trigger. Ultimately, the information's coming from God. And even if we're coming through these people, Daniel would still be able to make sense and see the truth of it in light of an elevation that God has given to his mind. Okay. So when the Babylonians, for example, they will talk about seven, you know, higher spiritual beings. But for the Persians, they end up basing that on the number of planets they know about. They're really basing that on astronomy. Whereas in the Hebrew tradition, there's no sort of correlation between the spiritual beings that you're talking about and then physical things out there, like planets or the sun, moon, stars. They're completely detached. Go ahead, Mrs. Kroll.
Would it be a distraction to talk about Lucifer in the context of you've got the archangels there and his name means the angel of light?
Yeah, I don't know that it would be a distraction. Lucifer, you first get that name in the book of Isaiah, and it's referring to Cyrus. It's referring to a Persian king. And I think it's in 20, I want to say 24, I think is where this occurs. But, you know, it's first applied to this Persian king or ruler. You know, you will ascend to heaven, you will be dashed to hell, you know, to call himself the day star or to think of himself as the day star. You have, like Nebuchadnezzar, like Balthazar, you've magnified your pride. You've inflated yourself. And so, yes, that was always understood as a figure for, you know, for the devil, for the devil, the head devil. But this, you don't get clear references in the book of Daniel to fallen spirits. Later, next week, we'll talk about how Michael talks about how the prince of Persia resisted me. And there are different interpretations. Is that like a evil angel and he beat him up? Is it like a lower angel and he didn't quite understand what the plan was? And so Michael had to have a organizational meeting with this angel. So, but we'll talk about that next time. But if you, in general, you have to say about the Old Testament that there is teeny tiny knowledge about evil spirits. So in Genesis, you're not told directly of a devil. You're told of a serpent. It isn't later until, let's say, the Book of Wisdom, that chapter 2, by the envy of the devil, sin entered the world. In other words, that you're told retrospectively, hey, that being that we're describing as the serpent, that's the devil. And then the devil doesn't appear in his own proper person really until the Book of Job. And then it's bizarre, isn't it? There he is coming in, talking to God, and God tells him, have you considered my servant Job? And the devil says, how good and just he is. And the devil says, oh, skin for skin. Of course he blesses you because he enjoys prosperity. But take from him what he has, and he will curse you to your face. Right? They're betting. God is wagering on someone's obedience. And what is the devil coming up and having conversations with him for? Job is a very strange book. There are people who want the thing to just be allegorical. When you look at the Church Fathers and when you look at St. Thomas, they will say it can't be. At the point where you get names and places, that's not allegory. In other words, Job lived in the land of Uz, and you get this kind of background. That's not the way allegory works. Allegory is more like what you see in the parables. There was an unjust judge. There was a rich man, right? You get that kind of thing. By the way, that's why people like St. Thomas and earlier some of the fathers, they will look at the story of the rich man and Lazarus, and this is going to be a little hair-raising to you. They will say, that's not a parable. At the point where you have the name Lazarus, that's not a parable. That is an actual history of a rich man and a poor man named Lazarus. And the rich man goes to hell. And Lazarus is Abraham's bosom and goes to heaven. Jesus is giving you a history. And the thing that tips you off is there are names. Okay? So that's kind of the case they make for Job. However strange the story may sound, you have to understand that some kind of communication is going on between God and the devil, at least in some symbolic way, because the point of the story is that this man really suffers and comes to some kind of real insight about what God is preparing for him. You don't want Job to just be a parable, right? This man is learning through this great suffering what God is preparing for him. You want that to be a real person who's offering a real example. Remember, fictional people, they can inspire you at some level. But the only way they can really inspire you is if real people could do what that fictional person does. And at the point where it's just all fictional, then it really isn't inspiring. Let's go. Did you want, was there anything
you want? Follow up then on,
go ahead.
The bigger picture of angels. All of the hierarchy of angels?
Yep.
Does that come from the Church Fathers?
No, that comes from, well, the fine points come from the Church Fathers, but in the Old Testament, you get seraphim described in Isaiah 6. The cherubim, remember there's a cherubim with a flaming sword that you're told about in Genesis 3, and then you're told later that their models of them are put on the Ark of the Covenant. Because there's a way in which the Holy of Holies is supposed to make represent to you the paradise, union with God. So you have cherubim, you have seraphim.
Thrones and dominions?
No, almost all of those are in St. Paul in Ephesians and Colossians. So principalities, powers, thrones, dominions, all of those are St. Paul. Of course, angel is all over the place. Archangels in a couple of different places, New Testament and Old Testament. So, in other words, that there are different orders of angels, if you like, or different rankings of angels, that's throughout Scripture. That you collect all that together and arrange it, that's patristic, that's Church Fathers. So, one that I was reading on this point was Dionysius the Areopagite, sometimes called Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, or sometimes Pseudo-Dionysius the Pseudo-Areopagite. Depends which thing you're reading. But he's one that will take that myriad of myriads business and explain this is to help you understand that there really is a spiritual multitude. This isn't just a few of them. The other one is Gregory the Great, so who writes the dialogues, who writes the commentary on Job, who's the organizer of what we call Gregorian chant. He has a treatise on the angels. And so when you read St. Thomas, he will draw both from Dionysius and from Gregory in terms of understanding the angels. And sometimes you have different, they interpret or read things in different ways, and he will harmonize their differences. Okay, let's at this point turn to the revelation of the four kingdoms. And what I did was, this is in your book in chapter 2. There's the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, where, remember, we have the statue, the head of gold, chest of silver, and then lower parts bronze, and then feet are iron or whatnot, or legs are iron, and then it goes into clay. And then, is this Darius at this point, or is this Belshazzar? Who has the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the horn? This is what's revealed to Daniel. So that's what's revealed to the king, that's what's revealed to Daniel. And, of course, commentators will ask, Why kind of repeat the vision, or why repeat the four kingdoms? Haven't you already taken care of your four kingdoms over here with Nebuchadnezzar? And one helpful contrast, Christopher Wordsworth makes this in his commentary, is that this is the revelation that's given to the king, this is the revelation that's given to the prophet, and they're given for different reasons. The revelation that's given to the king, in other words, when God, as it were, reveals things to rulers, what he's doing is trying to humble them, especially if you're the head of an empire. You know, you could use some humbling. So he's asserting his sovereignty to the king when he reveals that there's going to be a series of kingdoms. Kingdoms come and go. You're not the only catfish in the sea. You know, that sort of thing. Okay? Whereas when this series is being revealed to the prophet, there's a different reason for that. The prophet is being told of these changes because the prophet needs to understand himself, and he needs to be able to explain to others that even though there is turmoil and instability, that God is preparing some ultimate kingdom for the faithful. Okay? Because whether you're living in the present age or whether you're living at this period, political instability is distressful. Political instability is distressful, especially when you live in a country that's more or less at peace and, yes, has its stresses in this direction or that direction. But, you know, we aren't like in the 1860s in the middle of a civil war. You know, we're not in something where we're just wondering if the whole thing is going to go up in flames. If you're old enough to remember, you know, maybe there are points in the 60s where it just sort of felt that way, like the whole thing was just going to, right, collapse. Eve of destruction! Okay? But, so, what the prophet, the place of the prophet is to help people understand that even though what's going on out there may seem very bad and unstable and the whole thing's coming apart, God is preparing something for his people. Okay? And Wordsworth very helpfully points to these texts in the New Testament. Think about St. Paul in 1 Thessalonians. This is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where he talks about the coming of the Antichrist. Let no man deceive you by any means, unless there is a revolt first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and lifts up all that is called God, or all that is worshipped, so that he sits in the temple of God, showing himself as it were God. Remember, you not, you when I was yet with you, that I told you these things. So notice, that's even further than instability. In other words, there'll always be the tendency of the secular realm or the political realm to put itself first, to put itself above God, to say that this is what matters, and all that sort of pious religious stuff that you're yakking about, that doesn't matter. Remember that when people warned Stalin that Pius XI was writing an encyclical on communism, Stalin's response was, how many divisions does he have? Okay. Now, who got the last laugh out of that? But, of course, at the time, it really looked like, you know, the Soviet Union was the coming power, and they ultimately were going to win. Okay. This is from Revelation. And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. This is Apocalypse 13, 1 through 5. I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 diadems, and upon the heads names of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like to a leopard, and his feet were like feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his own strength and great power. And I saw one of the heads as it were slain to death, and death's wounds healed, and all the earth in admiration of the beast. And they adored the dragon, which gave great power to the beast, and they adored the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who shall be able to fight with him? And there was given him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given to him to do 42 months. Right? 42 months. Okay? Remember, the book of Revelation, however strange it sounds, the purpose of the book is in every age to help the faithful understand that secular powers wage against the church, but ultimately to help the faithful understand that there is some kind of culmination point of history, and it really is going to look darkest before the dawn. It really is going to look like the bad guys have won. Okay? And that you have to be prepared for that. Okay? And that somehow in every age, there's always going to be a time that it looks like the bad guys are winning. Okay? In every age. That's why if you look at the book of the Apocalypse and say, well, people thought that, you know, the world was going to end in 1000 AD, and they thought it was going to end at 1500, and they thought it was going to end, let's say, in 1800, and they were always wrong. And Cardinal Newman, when he addresses that, says, well, that's to pull away the wrong message from the book, because plainly the purpose of the book is that you stay vigilant and alert. And at the point where you walk away from the book, well, it was always wrong, then you're not going to stay vigilant and alert. No, our Lord has told you explicitly, be ready, watch, for you know not the day nor the hour. Okay. But the timeless value of the book is, even though whatever age you're living in may not be the age that's, as it were, the culminating age, the mindset that you have to have is the same. The mindset that you have to have is the same. So in other words, you have to be able to look at the turmoil and the tyranny and the injustice and the blasphemy around you with the conviction that ultimately the Lord is on his way, or the Lord is coming, or the Lord will restore what needs to be restored. You always have to have that mindset. And so even if there are things that match up in the book of the Apocalypse with what it is you see now, but it turns out the end of the world isn't for another 2,000 years or 1,000 years, that book is still useful to you because you still have to have the mindset. from your point of view, it could look fully well like the end of the world and feel like it. So you still have to have the trust that somehow, even though things look awful, that there is some kind of divine plan, there's some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. Not as my father used to say, which is just the headlamp of an oncoming train. Okay? And by the way, notice your hearing, what I read to you in Revelation, you're hearing kind of these same animals. You're hearing the same pattern. Because John is clearly drawing from the same, if you like, imagistic or symbolic pool in terms of understanding these powers, these worldly powers that arm themselves and array themselves against Christ's kingdom. Okay? So these visions, the vision you have in Daniel 2, that's to humble the ruler. And of course, that's the same thing going on with the writing on the wall. That's to humble the ruler. But now what we're being given is, in these visions, is that the prophet is able to bring to his people God's plan. And so that they will have hope and trust. And quite frankly, perseverance in light of what they're going to see or what they're going to undergo. That brings us over finally to point three here. If you're familiar with Ezekiel, then you're familiar with this phrase, Son of Man. That is used 92 times in Ezekiel. Ezekiel is commonly addressed by God as Son of Man. And that is a kind of prefigurement of what it is that you see in the Gospels, because Jesus addresses himself as the Son of Man. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith in the world? Okay? And in Daniel, Son of Man is used three times. Chapter 7, verse 13, chapter 8, verse 17, and then chapter 10. And it's not, at one point it's addressed, sounds like it's being addressed to Daniel, but other times it's being addressed about somebody else, somebody who's like the Son of Man. So in this vision of the Ancient of Days, there's this one like the Son of Man who will come before him and execute judgment. Okay? So when you read patristic commentary on this, there are people who want to call Jesus the Ancient of Days, and the Church Fathers will say, no, if anyone, that's God the Father. And God the Father is, as it were, being pictured on this throne. God the Son is the one who's coming before him and as the one who's like the Son of Man and carrying out his plan, carrying out his orders. When you see in artwork, you know, God the Father or God being pictured as an old man, that really goes back to this image from the book of Daniel. Remember, in Orthodox Judaism or traditional Judaism, you're not going to picture God at all. Okay? And it's only in Christianity that you start getting these pictures of God, these visualizations. And the legitimization for that is Jesus himself. Right? He gives you a visible God. You know, what you see is human, but of course, the divine is in some way shining through his humanity. And so that sort of opens up the doors, and then you get, you know, God the Father, and in these pictures of God the Father, who's kind of an old man, that's how he'll be described as the Ancient of Days. Okay? And the only thing that's sort of misleading about that is that when we talk about God being old, we're using our language for that, because that's the only way that we can understand something that is eternal, that somehow it's like just been around forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. But remember, from the divine point of view, there is no old or young. That's the thing that Augustine is trying to get at in the Confessions, where he talks about his conversion, and he will talk about how God is ever ancient and ever new. Ever ancient and ever new. That, remember, to be in the divine presence is to be in the presence of something that is always now. Now, when you try to explain that to, let's say, high schoolers, You know, what do you give them that will help that go in? And what I tell them is, you know, think about the difference between being in the dentist chair and the difference between being, let's say, in vacation, like Six Flags over Texas or whatnot. Okay? When you are in the dentist chair, you are completely aware of time. Tick, talk, tick, talk. You're completely aware of time. When you're at the amusement park, I mean, assuming that you're not like in line for Space Mountain, but if you're just enjoying yourself, right, half an hour, 2 hours goes by, and you're completely unaware of it. Okay? So hell, and to some degree purgatory, you would have this sense of time. It would seem or feel in hell it would be, and perhaps in purgatory it would seem to be, perpetual. Right? That you just have this sense of moment after moment after moment. Right? Whereas to be in union with God, there's still a sequence in your actions. Here you are talking to Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Have a great conversation. You move on to St. Francis of Assisi. Have a great conversation. Move on to, you know, John Paul II. Have a great conversation. Okay? So there still could be a sequence in your actions. But you would have no sense of whether that was an hour or a day or a month or a year. You would have no sense of that. So the closer you are to God, the less time matters, and the less you have a sense of time mattering. And that's why to be in hell, to be damned, is to be, as it were, trapped in time, trapped in the very sequence of one thing after the other. So if you truly want to talk about something being old, in a way, the damned are old, because the damned are trapped in time and change. Whereas the more that you are united with God, the more that you are freed from time, and the less of a sense that you have of time. So that's always the limitation with talking about God as the Ancient of Days. You're taking this notion from time and trying to, you know, give him this venerable and respectable title. But he's, of course, he's outside all that. He's outside all that. He's like the author outside the book. You know, from the characters and the point of view of, let's say, Tolstoy's War and Peace, I guess they think of Tolstoy as old. But Tolstoy has all the events in that book fully before his mind, right? He isn't in the book, and he isn't measured by the action of the book. All the action of the book is outside him, which he can consider as a whole all at once. Okay, so for next time, we'll talk about 9 and 10. Very good.